Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. I have Phuc Trang on, the author of Saigon. We had Phuc on many years ago when he was a young buck just starting out his writing career. I'm just kidding.
Yes, 6 years ago. It was 6 years ago.
No, was it?
Yeah,
20. I was literally joking about this, but but you're still a young buck.
Yeah, very young man. Thanks. Yeah. I'm gonna tell my kids that you called me a young buck.
I consider
you a young buck. I get called unk all the time by my nephews and stuff.
Unk.
thanks.
The reason I asked you to come back on, because I know that you just went to Vietnam, and this is 50 something years later. You left Vietnam when you were 2. So you're a young unk today, and I'm here to hear what you think of the trip before you left to Vietnam, and then your thoughts now that you've come back for a few weeks now. Let's start with what did you think Vietnam was going to be before you left? And all these years, 50 years of like living away from the homeland, what did you think it was going to be like?
Yeah, you know, my brother actually went like 20 years ago in the early 2000s. And then, you know, my aunts, like a bunch of aunts and uncles have been back. But they usually like tie those trips into like Singapore or Bali or like Japan. You know, and like, I think, I don't know, like, I have this expression among Star Wars fans. I always say like, nobody hates Star Wars as much as a Star Wars fan. And I feel like that's like low key also true for Vietnam. Like nobody hates Vietnam as much as other Vietnamese people. So my aunts were always like, oh, it's so dirty. It's crowded and people are rude. And like everyone's on their phones all the time and the phones are on full blast and like shit's crazy. And I was like, you know, but I think like, I'm reasonably good at just like having like sort of not having expectations about trips, you know, especially like traveling with kids. Like you just, you know, like when you're traveling with your family, like it just like stuff goes like shit goes sideways really fast, or just it doesn't go according to plan, and that's okay, right? And I think like that's like my biggest takeaway as a parent. So I really went into the trip with no expectations other than like, you know, let's not get food poisoning. Let's just accept that it's going to be like hot as fuck in, you know, the end of June and early July. It was amazing. I thought it was amazing. You know, I was like, man, like, how do I get back? How do I afford to get back? You know, we were talking about before we started the podcast about how expensive it is, you know, for the flight, especially for me being on the East Coast. Like maybe on the West Coast, it's you're cutting out like 6 hours of travel time. But yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I have a lot of thought, you know, I have like lots of like sort of complicated thoughts about like being Vietnamese American and sort of like learning stuff about my own family history, you know, especially in light of the wars there, and like sort of who was on what side. It's like, it's so complicated. It was fascinating for me, especially talking to our tour guides and sort of like getting some pretty frank opinions from them about the war. Like we went to the, you know, the American War Crimes Museum, or what they call it now, the War Remnants Museum. You know, we went to like the Coochie tunnels out inside, you know, outside of Saigon and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Do you regret not going earlier?
Yeah, for sure. Only because like it's so built up now. I think that was the thing that I was most surprised by, was especially like both like Saigon and Da Nang, especially like when we got to Da Nang, like our guide was like, welcome to Miami. And I was like, oh damn, like it's crazy. Like, I guess, I would have loved to have seen it like 20 years ago. Yeah. Yeah. And that's not me making like a judgment about what, you know, they're doing now. It's just like, I would have loved to have seen it. Like my favorite parts were the rural parts, you know, and I want to clarify, like, I wasn't there for like poverty porn. Like I didn't want to be like, ooh, people are so poor and here are some water buffaloes and they're wearing the rice hats. Like, I just loved seeing, like, you know, you see a city, you kind of like, they all kind of like have a, like this big city vibe, even though like, you know, like a Vietnamese city is very different from a European city. It's still a city. And I think like rural life just feels more different, and I was there to sort of experience, you know, sort of as much as I could and as many different things as I could. But yeah.
Are your mom and dad still around?
Yeah. And that was part of why I didn't go sooner. I spent so much time doing this like full court press on them to try to get them to go with me. Damn. And they were just like, nope. They will. I mean, they're very hard feelings, you know, for them. And so like after like 10 years of trying to get my parents to go and them just kind of like shooting me down, you know, I was like, okay, I guess I'll just go by myself. And then, you know, we had kids. This was like, you know, in our like 30s, you know, we started having kids. And then I was like, like, you know, now how do you do like a 2 week or 3 week trip to Vietnam when you have like infants? So then we were like, all right, let's wait till the kids are old enough, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I definitely wish, you know, and also it's just like a resources thing, you know, it's just like, you're in college and you're broke and then you're out of college and you're broke and you're in your 20s and you're just busy doing broke. Other dumb shit. Yeah. You're broke. Also broke, but then also like trying to do other dumb shit. And then, yeah. So
and then you have kids and then you're broke.
Yeah, totally. Basically just you're like broke all like varying degrees of being broke. And then at some point I was saying to you, and I don't mind saying this, like, you know, the airfare was so, we almost went with like my cousins last year, and the airfare was so expensive. Like we couldn't do it. It was like $2,500 a ticket. And then the only reason that we were able to afford this trip was because my uncle passed away and left me some money. And my aunt was like, this, use this money for the airfare. Like, don't be a dick. Like your uncle died, go on his dime. He'll be so pumped, you know, looking down at you from like Buddhist heaven or whatever.
So wait, this is your mom and dad's sibling. One of them.
Yeah.
Okay. This is your dad's brother, right? Yeah. Did your parents not like see your dad's brother going, wait a minute, I think he would have liked for Phuc and his family to go to Vietnam, and I'm gonna set aside some money? And I mean, still with all of that energy, like no change.
No, they just, I think it's maybe like less, it's less like bad feelings now. And they're just like, part of it is like, they're just like, we're too old. It's going to be too hard. And like the travel's too, you know, my parents are in their 70s now. It's real, right? It's like that flight, well, maybe not as hard from California, but it's like, you know, it's like for us from the East Coast, it was like a 27 hour travel day, wow. You know, like with like layovers and stuff. So it's hard. I think it's just like too hard for them now. And frankly, like, you know, as you know, like, They have all the Vietnamese shit they want in Orange County, California. They're kind of like, I don't want, it's like, it's almost like first world Vietnamese stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're like, I don't want to go back. And, you know, all that said, like, you know, when we were, you know, on our block in Saigon, and like, I was like sending photos to my dad and like all this stuff. And he was like very, he was very responsive. And he's like, oh my God, I remember that, you know, our neighbor Tuyik, she lives in the back alley, da 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 da, you know? So it was like very, you know, like he was engaged. And I think even from my back and forth with my father, I think there's a part of him, I don't know, I don't think he would admit it, but I think there's a part of him that's like, I wish I'd gone back. I don't get the sense, I don't have a clear sense of how many sort of Viet Kieu go back to Vietnam. Like, I'm sure it's different, but like, what is your sense in your community, Kenneth? Like, how many people go back to Vietnam to travel?
Everybody goes back here. I think on the West Coast we go a lot because of our proximity, but I think there's also this sort of open-mindedness when you're around a lot of Vietnamese people who are constantly talking about being in Vietnam, and you're having FOMO. That's a big part of it, you know. And no matter how anti-government or anti-whatever you are, you're going to be thinking about, oh my God, all these like generals and lieutenant colonels are going back now, and they're like, they're having a great time. I mean, so I don't think, the West Coast has a problem with going back as much as the East Coast people.
Yeah. And maybe it's just like certain generations of people, you know. I think like my parents held out for so long because of like their politics. And then now,
you know, let's do a thought exercise. What Where in the world would you, other than Vietnam or the US, where in the world do you find it to be super amazing? And if you had a chance, you would relocate there?
Oh, to live?
To live. You know, in your entire life. You know, is it, has it been Paris? Has it been London? I guess because we think that we live in the best country in the world, the United States. I mean, traditionally, that's how we've thought, right? Not anymore. But yeah. I'm thinking, like, if I came from Vietnam back in the 70s, and I'm your dad and my dad, and I'm like, oh, that is like living in the best place in the entire universe. Yeah. Why would you ever want to go back to Vietnam, I guess? That's the only way I could see our parents' generation making that decision. It's like, that's the only way I get it. It's like, oh, okay, I made it to the promised land. There's no reason I'm going to go back in time and like go back to this. To them, probably was a really bad place. I was going to use some other choice words.
And also, like, I mean, they lost a civil war. So, like, in their mind, they're like, the country that they know is totally gone, right? Like, it's like, you know, and the house is demolished and all this stuff. So, yeah. Yeah.
And then they probably, I've never talked to anybody about this, but they probably feel a certain way about being responsible for the loss, maybe, or being on the losing side. And maybe there's a shame that I've never heard anybody talk about, like, the shame of losing, but I'm sure that's part of the, that's got to be part of the equation where you don't want to go back.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, I don't think anyone would ever verbalize this, but they're like, I'm sure there's like the thought of like, were we on the wrong side? You know what I mean? Like, you know, not necessarily by choice, but like, were we just born into a situation where
right.
the bad guys, maybe, I don't know.
Like, I know a lot of second generation guys like our age, you know, are thinking that all the time, but they can't admit it because nobody wants to.
No.
Wait, you're born on the Confederate side? I mean, I hate to make that comparison.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I've made that comparison too. Yeah, for sure, for sure. So wait, if you don't mind me asking, so
please ask.
Your parents' generation, like most of those folks have gone back to Vietnam?
Multiple. My dad lived there with my brother back in 04, 02, 03, 04.
Yeah.
For many years, and they started businesses, and you know, they really got active.
That's amazing.
My dad was like, he was very intellectual about the whole thing. He was always like, there's no national pride in him. He was always like, the only language I speak is the language of intellectuals. He used to always say that to me. In Vietnamese, he said, there's only one language of intellectuals. Show me some thinking, you know, show me some critical thinking, and then we're in business. And it doesn't matter if it's in Vietnamese, in Latin, in Greek, in Chinese. Yeah. If we're talking about the exchange of thinking and thoughts, we're going to be okay. It doesn't matter where. And we can debate the thinking and the thoughts till we're blue in the face and we're still going to have a great time. But if we're debating nationalism and whose national dishes are better, that's when we're going to find ourselves in some deep doo-doo.
Yeah. That's super interesting. Yeah. Huh. I love that. I mean, I love that. And I think I guess, you know, my parents are just like outliers in that regard, in the sense of like that they're refusing to go back. I'd be curious. Maybe I'll ask next time I see them or talk to them. I'll ask them like how many of their sort of Orange County friends are holdouts, like they are.
Oh, I'm not saying there's no holdouts. There are holdouts. Yeah.
I'm just curious if like my parents, you know, like I wonder if it's like my parents are like 50-50 or whatever. Also, it's like an age thing, right? Like it's like, you know, like
totally
you said, like that flight is just so burly and.
but being born in America for me, I can't imagine not going to the homeland. I can't imagine not knowing who my ancestors were. I can't imagine like thinking or not thinking about where these bowls of like hutiu come from. And I just can't do it. You know, it's like impossible for me to not like live in the excitement and the curiosity of like where our culture comes from.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Then if I was thinking of America as what they say in Vietnamese, Một cái nước siêu cường, which is a super, you know, it's a super nation. They're not going to They're not going to reach the shores of the U.S. and then want to go back to Vietnam in their lifetime.
For sure. Yeah. And I think like there was like, and for me, I think like going back, I was like, oh, there's like parts of me that are very like, I'm like, oh, that's like culturally, I was like, oh, this is very Vietnamese. And then there are other parts of me, I was like, nope, I'm so Americanized. Like the cutting in line. Oh my God. I'm like,
drives you nuts.
Stand in line. Like, why are you like, and it's like little old ladies and like, you know, little aunties and just. And finally, you're just like, okay, I guess I got to be a dick and like push somebody up. Yeah, the cutting in line was really culturally like probably the most, like more than the driving. The driving, I'm like, all right, that's fine, whatever. Like, you know, everybody's like, you know, they're all on the road. Like, you know, they're sort of like mutually assured destruction if like you drive like an asshole. But like the cutting in line was so brutal.
That is so funny. That is so funny. I would stand in line thinking, I'm not being a dick. I'm just being Vietnamese and there's nothing to judge here. You know what I mean? Right, nothing to judge here. Cause everybody's doing it. And I think that there's no, I think all over Asia, it's that way. Yeah. I think in China is like notorious for that. Hong Kong is bad. Vietnam's bad.
Yeah.
But I think the whole idea of like standing in line comes from England, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, like, I don't know if you ever heard like, you know, Viet Thanh Nguyen like tell that story about how like when he and his dad, I'm telling his story, but you know, I think it's like, it's out there in the world. Like, you know, his dad was always like, you know, you're Vietnamese, we're Vietnamese. And then we went back to Vietnam and then they came back and he's like, oh my God, no, we're so American. Like, you know, they were just like, they've been here too long or whatever, but it was, you know, I don't think it's like quite like that for me, but I appreciate the opportunity to reflect on the things for me that I see in myself that's like very Vietnamese. And then the things that are like, oh yeah, like I like an orderly line, you know, yeah. I like taking a number and being like, okay, I'm number 50, you know, instead of just like the scrum at the window, right? You know, it's wild. Yeah. I also like price tags. I don't like haggling. Like haggling really, I find it really stressful, especially like the class thing, right? Like you show up and you're just like, you know, Vietnam is very poor. And I'm just like, I don't want to haggle with this old lady, like, or the whoever, you know what I mean? Like, just tell me what the price is. And then like, you know, then they think you're a dick. Cause like, they like, you know, they like ripped you off or whatever. I'm like, no. I like whatever you're charging, like I'll pay it. Cause like at the end of the day, like, it's like $3 or $4 difference.
Yeah. But let me give you some insight. Okay. Let me give you some insight. Okay. So if you're in Jabendhan, right? Which is the big market, right? If you're in so many of those stalls are impossible to buy. You can't just like get a stall, right? And you don't realize like you're negotiating with people who have more money than you do.
You think so?
For a fact. Folk, this is a fact. A lot of those stall owners are generational wealth. They come from a lot of money to be in there. They're printing money. They make more money than you in one day than you make in a month, right? Really? So you're sitting there.
That makes me happy to hear, actually.
So you're sitting there thinking poor, but that's not the case at all.
They
are rich. The people in that market, I found out, you know, families told me, you know, we're making a lot of money. Like to buy a stall there is like no easy feat. You've had to like really grind it out for so many generations to finally make it in there. And then once you're in there, you're making a lot. And then they're looking at you like poor fool, poor American, like you're just chum for their, you know.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
you're
fair.
Just a big bluefin tuna, you know, and they're just fishing. Yeah.
And I appreciate that. It's good to know. I'll keep that in mind. I mean, also like it also just feels like such a tourist trap there, right? Yeah. You're just it's like it's just crazy. I mean, I went just to the court of like look at it, but I was like, I can't buy anything here. This is too crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts.
Yeah.
Are you?
Kenneth, have you traveled the length of the country? Like you've done like Hanoi, Sapa, like all the way down.
Mm-hmm. I did it my first time when I went back with my mom and dad. I was like in my early 20s, maybe 22, 23. So my mom and dad had hired a driver with the
Terry at that point.
Yeah, I just got out of the military. right? Yeah. A year or two. Yeah. And they hired a driver with a 12-seater or 15-seat passenger bus. And so we went with like my mom and dad's uncles and cousins. So it was like a grown-up trip with like these old school people. Like half that van has died off. Like, you know, like uncles and stuff to have died. But we went from Saigon to Hanoi. We went actually all the way down to Kamau, which is the southern tip. And then we went back up.
Wow.
So we
or something?
3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
3 weeks, yeah. I took a picture of my mom and dad sitting on this beautiful mountaintop. I forget the name of the... I know the name. I have to look it up. But it ended up being my mom and dad's tombstone. The shot that I took, them sitting together. My mom's still alive, but she wanted that to be the tombstone because they're both going to be they're buried together in one lot. Mm-hmm. And so that was like the first shot that I took of them. And every time I visit my dad, I'm reminded of that first trip that we had as a family back to Vietnam together.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I think it's Dao Hai Van is the name of it. Yeah.
Wow. Good job. I can't believe you just...
I want to know when you went back this time, did it create material for another book perhaps?
I mean, I took notes for sure. Like I took a ton of notes. Part of me is just like processing it still, you know, like it's less than we've only been back in the US like two, three weeks. I don't know what I would say that isn't like super cliche either, you know, like, so I think in some ways, like, it's like, oh, like, I think I'm just having all the things that like many sort of like, you know, VQ have when they visit Vietnam or like, you know, there's like a spectrum of emotions and feelings there. Maybe an essay for sure. But I don't know if it's going to be like a full blown book, you know, like, I think if I did a book, it would be like, you know, it's like, Fook and Kenneth rent motorcycles and we ride from Saigon to Hanoi. Like that I think, like, you know, some hijinks would ensue.
That would be dope.
Like that's a book. Cause you know, like, I you know, I know who knows. But
motorcycle diaries action. I would love that.
Yeah. We need like a new version of like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle
Maintenance.
Yeah. But I've been thinking about how can you not travel there? I mean, just traveling in general, but like, I think a place that like has like sort of like emotional weight like that and not have it sort of like trigger, an engagement and sort of like deep inquiry inside. I think it just takes a long time for me to process, you know, or it's going to take some time to process, but yeah.
Do you think any of the real Vietnam has erased or demolished any of the fantasy Vietnam that you had in your mind?
I don't know. I think only because I traveled to China maybe 10 years ago and I remember we were on a tour and, you know, we were in like Shanghai and like Beijing. And, when we went to like the rural parts of China, I was like, oh, like in some ways, right. It's like the thing that like meets your expectations, right? It's like a little bit of like this like Western gaze, I guess, you know, where like you're like, oh, this is a China that I thought I would see in my brain. And or you know, like, I don't want to use the word authentic. It was just like the China that I thought I would see, like I saw it and I was like really excited by it. And not that like Shanghai is like not amazing, but it's just like crazy. And it just looks like Blade Runner or something, right?
Yeah.
And and our tour guide was just like, oh, you just want to see the poor China. And I was like, oh, damn. Like, he really, like, called me out on it. Not in, like, a mean way, but he was just like, he's like, there's more to China than just, like, poor China. And I was like, oh, like, that made me reflect a lot. So I think, like, on this trip, like, I really wanted to be sort of thoughtful about, like, I'm just going to see what I see. Like, I don't have expectations for it. I was really surprised by how built up it was, how propulsive, like, the infrastructure, the investment in infrastructure is. That was seemed really intense, you know. And I asked like one of our guides, I was like, what are you guys thinking about, like, the environmental impact on stuff, you know, like, it's just like, you know. And he was just like, this is the price you pay for not being, you know, for joining, I guess, let's just call it the first world or whatever, right? Like a you know, capitalism. Like, it's just like, they're like, so like, they're all in on capitalism and the free market. Right. And like, the government obviously is still communist or single party, but, and he's just like, environment and, you know, like, whatever, like, he's just like, how else are we going to, like, you know, have a seat at the table? So I worry about that, but it's also like, it's a privilege for me to be like, oh, but totally. Guys, like, potable water, you know, like, why don't you work on that or whatever, you know, like, yeah. What are your thoughts? Like, I mean, you've seen it for 20 years now. Like, you saw it like before, like NVIDIA and Apple and, you know,
yeah,
you know, Nike invested all the money in there.
I have my thoughts on the pollution thing, but
yeah, tell
I'll
me
bring it back.
Let me hear about that too.
I'll bring it back to three different countries. My first country is watching LA pollution in the 80s. I remember how thick that smog was, right? It was so thick. Then I remember going to Shanghai in 2007 and how thick Guangdong, Guangzhou, all of those places, their pollution was super thick. I haven't been back since, but I've heard that they've cleaned it up tremendously. They've done a great job cleaning up Shanghai. So I don't know what it was like 10 years ago for you, but I remember it being the Jetsons. And I think 20 years ago, it was relatively polluted, but it wasn't like LA pollution. Mm-hmm. LA pollution was like not the carburetors or whatever. They didn't have filters and they didn't have laws to protect the environment in LA in the 80s when I was growing up going to elementary school. I remember how much of a headache I would have coming home from school every day. And then I remember Shanghai. And then I remember in the most recent trips going, that is the price of modernizing Vietnam. But it will be cleaned up because they talked about it. And I don't know, for whatever political purpose or economic reasons, they're talking about banning anything with the gas brand motor. Right. So everything's supposed to go back to, or you're supposed to go to electric vehicles, whether it's motorbikes or cars. So they had this big push. But then there's this like this political side of this big push, talking about VinFast being the reason why the government's pushing for everything to go to electrical vehicles. I don't know what to believe. It doesn't matter to me. But I know within 10, 15 years, as everybody's not worried about lining their pockets, which I think eventually happens in every society. People, the young people will remember, oh my God, I grew up in dirty, polluted air. I need to not have my children go through that. So the Politburo, I think, will make strides to clean it up as people get more rich and they're not concerned as much about making that kind of money that the previous generations, like China and Angelinos, were when Los Angeles was industrializing in the 50s and 60s. So I think it's just really an evolution of these major cities that become richer. And as a result, people want better lives. You know, like LA now is like, it's not perfect, but it's not near as polluted as it was when I was growing up. So there's always that hope for me when I think about Vietnam. I'm a very optimistic guy when it comes to this.
That's really optimistic. Yeah. Okay. What about the water, like the potable water piece? You know, it's like right now you have like 100 million people all drinking like plastic, you know.
Infested water, microplastics in the seeped in. I think that's happened in LA too. I think that's very difficult.
Like, that's just like, it is what it is.
It is what it is. But I think that there are a lot of filtration systems being sold both in LA and in Saigon that you can connect to your water. But these are powerful filtration systems that are being sold on the market, you know, but what can we do? I think it's in LA too.
Yeah.
What else you got, Fulton?
What do you want to hear about?
I have my question, but if you have questions for me, I'm here for it too.
Yeah. I mean, when you go back now, it's just like a family trip. Like, you just always go to Saigon to visit your brother. And have you, and I guess you've been going back for 20 years. So like, you've really like traveled to all the corners of Vietnam.
I wouldn't say all the corners.
Have you been to Da Nang Hills?
I have not. I've not been at Da Nang. I've not been to Bon Hills. Yeah. I mean, no, I've been on the first trip, but I've not been back.
Yeah. It's crazy. I'm curious about, I don't know. What's your feeling on like the sort of watching like the infrastructure and like the modernization, for lack of a better word, sort of explode?
I think there's always going to be mixed emotions for me. Mm. Oh my God. On one hand, I'm like, oh my God, this is so beautiful to watch Vietnam prosper. But on the other hand, what am I going to say? Hey guys, slow it down. We still like the poverty porn that we get to consume on the outside. It's not fair. It's not fair to have that, you know? So I think that with development comes its pros and cons. And I think that it's almost like an exercise in futility at this point to really debate it, because it's going to happen. There is corruption, like there is in every growing society. It will slow down like every society that grows. You know, Los Angeles is slowed down with this growth and building out and building up. It's, you know, I think it's going to run its course as well. And I think that I'm here to see and be excited about how far it gets to run. That being said, I really do think that environmentalists eventually will put the kibosh on Vietnam's development eventually. And I think it happens when, sounds really weird, but when people have enough, and people will get enough. And I'm not saying people our generation. I think the young kids of parents of our generation, they're going to be like, Mom, Dad, we have enough. We have to stop this. And I don't think it's happening in our lifetime. But it will happen. Yeah, I think it does happen.
Well, and tell me about, like, did you have a feeling like when you, like, especially in your sort of like long view of it, like the things that, like, do you associate the modernization of Vietnam with Westernization? So there's no way for Vietnam to modernize and also maintain sort of its distinct Vietnamese-ness.
Very difficult.
Because it's
very,
like,
difficult.
It's all bending around commerce, like capitalism, right? And capitalism is distinctly Western, right? With, like, you know, profit and loss and sales and, like, you know, timely delivery of product and blah blah blah.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history, these deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at HMart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com. You have to be very mindful if you're a young person in the development space, whether it's the architecture, the food, the music, whatever, to be very mindful to make it stay distinctly Vietnamese. It's very hard. And here's what I mean. I think in every field, there's like this idea of best practices, right? So like if you're building a mall, they're going to be like, wait, what's the best way that you can have people flow through this thing and maximize your dollars? Like, how do you set up the elevators, escalators, theater? Like, so everything's laid out like all the best malls in Dubai, right? Or all the best malls in wherever the best malls are. And where did the best malls learn from? They learned from that previous iteration of the best malls. I think the kitchens are the same. I think the Michelin restaurants are the same. What does a dining experience of the best feeling come from? Well, it's been studied through whatever, you know, food production. And I think that to make anything different, you really have to be very intentional. And I think that's where everybody in the world, maybe there's fault with that. Like, we don't want to think outside the box, and we don't want to think about, like, being intentional about how distinctly wonderful our cultures are. So we want to, like, We want to jump ahead and be like, okay, what makes most economic sense? How can we make the quickest buck? And then put some skins on top of it, right? Like, let's just make it feel like it's Vietnam, but at the end of the day, the engine's got to be efficiency. And efficiency has predominantly come from the West, or, you know, iterations of things from the West. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
Not a fact, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah. My aunt, when she was just there like 4 months ago, maybe, but she, you know, she was texted with me and she was just like, you know, it makes for her as like an OG, you know, Vietnamese person from the 60s and 70s. She was like, oh, it feels like they're just like they're changing themselves in order to appeal to like, or at least on the tourist side, right? Like, or on the travel and tourist side, like that they're changing themselves to accommodate like the sort of the money that's coming in and also losing the thing that like made them distinctly Vietnamese. It made her sad, but I
think that is the hallmark of progress. And here's what I mean by that. Like, I think if you like, and obviously these are no hard and fast rules, but I think that when you think about systems of finance, systems of movie making, systems inside of a kitchen that come from France, systems that come from movie making that comes from like the Jewish culture in the US, movie making dating back to, you know, the days of the founding of USC, the university, and how they like indoctrinate movie making at that level, and then it's like built out like the military is built out when you make a movie. All of these best practices are now done in Vietnam. I think that whether they're adapting it in a smooth and efficient way, or they're doing it whatever way they are, but it's still like the best practices. And I think the best practices are creating all of these products that we get to enjoy with some level of our cultural intentional littering in the process of whatever we're making.
Yeah. And it makes me think about like, what are the things, like what are the pillars of a culture, right? Like it's like the language, the cuisine, the customs, and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, like you said, like, I think there's, you know, I don't want to like fossilize Vietnamese culture in amber and like be like, no, you can't, you know, you can't progress or grow or anything like that. You know, in the same way that like, you know, I go back and, you know, I call an airport, you know, Phuong, and then everyone laughs because they're just like, that's not what you call an airport. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm speaking like 70s Vietnamese, you know, and or a bathroom. I was just like, toilet? And they're like, missing. I was like, okay, I don't know. Anyway, it's, yeah, I mean, you know, let them progress the way they want to progress. And I think the thing that I also took away that I thought was really interesting was like thinking about how Vietnam has always been at the crossroads of many places and cultures, like for a lot, you know, thousands of years, let's say, right? It was like the Chinese and the Khmer, right? Or the Champa people and then the French. And so like, I think it's always just been at a crossroads. Yeah. It's always like taking in influences and you know, and also as a Vietnamese American, like I, you know, obviously like my opinion is just like, it's whatever, you know? But I think it's fascinating to, I guess I want to be open to having Vietnam and young Vietnamese people change and adapt and take in more influences and keep moving it forward. And if it means like taking some, you know, capitalism and American culture and like, you know, putting it in the cocktail shaker and shaking it up, and it's going to be different, right? Like, it's not going to be like a cookie cutter version of America, but like, you know, good for them. Yeah. I'm with you. I think.
Would you ever move and retire to Vietnam?
I literally, only because I did the math, I was like, God damn, it's so affordable here other than the airfare. I was like, I wonder if my 401k could float me in Vietnam. How would I do that? I mentioned it to my wife and she was like, she's like, it's crazy hot here. And I was like, I know, but there is air conditioning. Also, you just get used to it. I don't know. It crossed my mind. I'm so far. I don't know. I'll probably work till I'm dead anyway, but it did cross my mind. What about you? Have you thought about it? Are you going to do it?
I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time. It really depends on my children. If one of them, I just need to have one of the two of them say, no, I want you here with me. And I won't leave.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
if
yeah.
both of them are like, dad, go do your thing. Go have a great time. Yeah, I'll be out. Yeah. And if if they're in New York or if they're in DC and I don't get to see them like, but once or twice a year, then what difference is, I'd probably see them more if they, you know, yeah, I just don't think, but if they lived in LA and they stayed here, then I think we're going to, I think if they said, please stay, I'd stay.
Yeah. Do you know that if it's easy to, for like, let's say if you decided in the next 10 years to like, I mean, you wouldn't buy property, but like you could like rent an apartment or something.
You can rent an apartment, but you can also buy like a pretty decent condo for like $350 right now.
Hmm. That's crazy.
You got to pay some HOA, like $100 or something like that. But I mean, fully like, you know, there's a pool and it's safe and you're gated and all of that. I mean,
and yeah.
You know, how much is it really? I know so many expats, you know, so many Vietnamese have gone back to Vietnam and retired. And they would, and if you ask them, they would be like, are you crazy? Why would I not do this? My money gets to be stretched at least 6 to 10 times, you know, depending on where you are.
Yeah. 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 That's, yeah. I thought about that as soon as, you know, it's funny. I mentioned that to my wife. I was like, oh, I don't know. We'll see. I'd love to go back. I'd love to go back. You know, like we, on this trip, like we were there for 2 weeks and we booked the whole trip through a tour company. And I was just like, okay, let's pretend this is the only trip I'm ever going to take to Vietnam. Like, let's go for it. Like, you know, so it was like super intense. Like we like did a lot, And so I think like, I would love to go back and have it be a slightly more relaxed trip where like I got to eat like more fun, you know, like I was just like, you know, yeah, there's so many things I wanted to eat and places I wanted to go. Like we didn't go to Sapa, you know, and wow. Like, yeah. Anyway,
you got to go to Hanoi.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. We landed in Hanoi. Yeah. And, that was where we landed. And it was so funny. Like we got there and I was like, is my Vietnamese really bad? Like, what is it? Is it really bad? Like, I have such a hard time understanding people. And then later in the trip, I was like, oh, that was just like the Hanoi accent. It was like so hard. Like,
right,
so
right. Hard. So difficult to understand. It is if you're not used to it. It really does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we were talking to, when we were in Da Nang, we were talking to our tour guide. And I was like, oh, I understand you way better. And I was like, do you have a problem with the Hanoi accent? He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, I never understand what like Hanoi people are saying to me. I was like, okay, that makes me feel a lot better.
I mean, it's almost like a different language.
It's, yeah. Like, instead of saying like, joo, they would say like, joo. And I was like, oh, like, what? I was like, it was like the tones were like crazy. Yeah. Anyway, it's just, you know. Yeah, it was amazing. Have you talked to many people on your podcast about like their sort of trips back? And
I try to every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I try to. Every time I know somebody who hasn't been back, you know, ever, like Chris Doe, you, first time coming back, if they've been on the podcast, I always reach out because they always post something like you did. Yeah. Oh my God, it's my first time back. So I always reach out to them and like, hey, let's talk about this.
Yeah. So and I want to.
Can I tell you? Some guys go back twice a year after that. For you know, they just keep going back.
I would love to. Yeah, I just got to win the Powerball or something. So, when we're sort of going back to like when we were talking about like, you know, sort of thinking about like, oh, were we like on the right side or the wrong side? We were in the Mekong Delta in My Tho, and I like texted my dad, and he's just like, oh, that's where your grandmother's from, and like your great grandfather had a hotel there. And I was like, oh, what happened to him? And he's like, oh, he got dragged out in the middle of the night and murdered and thrown into the Mekong River. And I was like, shit. I was like, I didn't know this story. Right. So I was like, what happened? It's like during the 1940s, during Japanese occupation.
Yeah.
And like the Viet Minh, right. Who, just for your listeners, I guess, like, so the Viet Minh during the 40s, were trained by the U.S. government, right, like the OSS, to resist the Japanese. Like Ho Chi Minh is a product of U.S. training to resist the Japanese. So is that loosely right? Does that jibe with what you understand, like the Viet Minh in the 1940s, World War II, to be?
I think there are so much covert operations that were happening that I have never heard of anything confirmed, but I have also heard what you've heard, and I've also heard people fight back that as well, because there's just so many opposing views about this, but I've heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my understanding of it. But what I do know is that like the Viet Minh came to my great grandfather, you know, who owns this hotel, and they're like, we need your help resisting the Japanese. And he's like, no, I'm going to collaborate with them. So they like drag him out in the middle of the street and execute him and then throw him in his body. So I text my dad. I'm like, so was he like a collaborator with the like Japanese? Like, was he just sort of like, whoever's the boss, like I'm with you. And my dad was just like, no, not at all. He's like, he just hated the French. He hated the French so much that he was so delighted that the Japanese had kicked the French out.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, great, I love you guys. And I guess in his mind, he like was worried maybe that like the Viet Minh were going to like not, you know, create a vacuum for the French to come back. I have no idea. Anyway,
yeah.
It was just fascinating to, in a quick succession of text messages, to be like, oh man, I was like, my great grandfather was like a collaborator with like, you know, occupying, you know, colonial forces. And I was like, and my dad's like, no, he just hated one colonial, you know, sort of power more than the other. And I was like, all right, I guess that makes sense. It's complicated, but it's so complicated.
And so, you know, here's the real crazy complication is that I have never really heard from my mother's generation or my grandmother's generation a hatred for the French, always a hatred for the Japanese.
Huh. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I hear a fair, and I have relatives who are French. Yeah.
They love the French. Vietnamese people love the French. I think it's like us studying history and realizing, no, all colonizers are bad.
Yeah.
But it's more nuanced than that. The more I get to sit with people, the more I realize like there are people that absolutely love the French. And my grandfather or my grandfather was also killed in the same time frame, 1943, killed by the Viet Minh because he also didn't want to collaborate, but he was also a French, blessed by the French to be the town police. So he was backed by the French. So the Viet Minh killed him too.
That's so wild. Literally killed both of our great grandfathers, but both of our great grandfathers refused to collaborate for different reasons, right?
Totally.
It's just like,
Totally. And and then that begs the question, like, here's a thought that I think about a lot is that my grandfather served the French. And then my dad and his brothers were in the CIA Phoenix program. And so they served the Americans. And then my brother and I, both U.S. Marines. So up and down the chain are arguably people who are born on the wrong side of history to the people of Vietnam. To the 100 million people in Vietnam right now, this is a family of white-loving... Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Bunch of Uncle Toms.
And I got into a big fight at a dinner one time with some really, some really respected people in the Vietnamese community here in Lewis, Saigon. And I was like saying, you know, I have this sub-series with this professor from Amsterdam. He's Vietnamese. And, you know, we're thinking about calling heroes of the Vietnamese heroes. And one of them out of the six was Ho Chi Minh, you know. And the other five guys were like political ideologists that were trying to break free from the French. And here I am as a child of the South, you know, harping on how beautiful, like, this title could be, you know, Vietnamese heroes. And the whole table walked out of the dinner. It was maddening. Yeah. After that. And I didn't talk to many of these people.
Because you included Ho Chi Minh in that list.
Yeah, because I said, maybe at one point we were born on the wrong side and, you know, guns were drawn, you know. I'm like, hey, this is a thought experiment. You know, I have the right to say all this because we are white. We're Uncle Toms. Like, I can say that because I went through it. You know, I served the U.S. I did my time. I did my tour. My brother did too. My dad and his brothers. We all like all, we're on the same. We're on the side of democracy. And yeah, it's weird how you just can't say whatever you want to say when you know you have this responsibility to honor the folks that lost their lives in this particular fight.
Yeah, and it's really hard for people to come to terms with. You know, the idea that they might, or their ancestors or their family might not have been the good guys. I think we all want to be the heroes, right? Yeah. Like, it's really hard to interrogate a narrative or to even entertain a narrative in which you are not the good guy of your own life, never mind totally. History, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I could say that about my time in the Marines. I could say that just, I'm not going to comment on my dad and his dad's time, but I can comment on my time. It wasn't a mistake that I did that. I mean, I had to go through it. I mean, it was just part of my life experience and I don't regret it, but I can also, two things can be true at the same time. I had a great experience. You know, very proud that I did that. But at the same time, I can also say, you know, I'm not very proud of a lot of things the United States have done in the last 50 years of me being alive. Including the time that I served in the Marine Corps, you know?
Yeah.
I was just reading a statistic there. The bombings and the destruction of war in the world has 90% the United States footprint in it. Whether it's selling missiles or weapons or actually flying our own planes, U.S. planes, over to drop bombs, we are responsible for 90% of the destruction. And then you go and you think about China in the last, I don't know, 100, 200 years. Has there been any destruction coming out of China? It's like nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, other than like brutal repression, right? But
totally.
Not on the scale of the US. And also, like, there's no other country in the world that has like military bases everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
I mean, imagine if like China had like a Air Force base in the US. Like, people would be losing their minds. But like,
it'd be completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
Even if China had a base in Guam, it would be completely like, what?
Yeah. But like, you know, I mean, it's like the tentacles of the Defense Department are long and you know, anyway,
they're deep. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, that's fascinating. What do you like, I guess, you know, I'll say this is so superficial. I talked to my cousin. She like lived in Vietnam for a while and like prepping for the trip. And, you know, and I feel like we really prepared very well because we like overplan and we travel a lot. But I brought all this bug spray and there were no bugs. Bro, where were the bugs? There was like no mosquitoes.
Where did you stay?
We're in the city. We're in Hanoi. We're in Ninh Binh. We're in, you know, Ha Long Bay. We're in Da Nang. We're in Hoi An, we were in
Saigon,
we were in Cần Thơ, we were in Mỹ Tho, no bugs. We were in the jungle.
That is trippy.
Is that, somebody said that maybe it was like just so hot in the summer that like the bugs weren't out? I don't know.
I've never thought about it. I'm not a mosquito attracting blood type person. Yeah. So I don't get bit often. I do get bit, but not as often to the point where I'm thinking about bug spray not working or no need for bug spray.
Yeah.
That's just a really interesting point though.
I was very surprised. No bugs. And all four of us, like my kids and my wife,
nobody.
Where are the bugs? It was wild. Anyway, other than that, I mean, and frankly, that was like a, you know, that was like a 5-star experience. I was like, great. Like I'm not getting eaten alive in the jungle.
Wow. How did your kids feel about the trip?
They loved it. They did. But, you know, like we really like try to give them a, you know, a pep talk and, you know, and just to talk about like the itinerary and like how, and like, I was like, this is not a time to be a picky eater. Just fucking eat whatever's in front of you. And, you know, it's going to be what it's going to be.
How old are they?
They're 12 and 15. So just about to turn 13 and 16. And like they're old enough that where you can like reason with them, you know? They were great. They were really great. I think it was, I think like the chaos of it was very eye opening for them. Cause we've traveled to Europe a lot, you know, and this was the first time that they were traveling to like, I guess like the developing world. They're like, holy shit. Like, you know, watching like dudes like doing like hardcore construction in like flip flops, you know, they're like, oh, like there's no OSHA here. Like, you know, or like, and I think like maybe like on the second or last night there, they saw some like street kids, like some, you know, beggar kids, you know, homeless kids, I guess, in Saigon. And they were, that was like, that was really like upsetting for them. They're like, those kids didn't have shoes. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, probably because they're homeless. I don't know. Like, and then also seeing some like Agent Orange, you know, sort of folks.
Deformities.
Who, like, they were like, whoa. I was like, yeah. So that was, I think it was good. It was great for them. Like, I think it's going to be a long time for them to process, you know, and they'll have like sort of, you know, different takeaways, you know. I think it's still pretty fresh for them, but all in all, like it was an amazing trip for all of us.
I'm glad to hear that. And I'm so happy that you, are willing to share and be so open about the trip. It sounds like you had a great trip, and I want to ask you, what, are you doing any, are you writing, not about the trip or anything like that? Cause I asked you that, but know, are you working on a new book? What's next?
Yeah. I just got out from under my, I just finished like fulfilled my contract for the kids book series, the Cranky the Crane series. And then I actually have a writing retreat coming up, in like a month, where I'm just going to go off into the woods, at this artist retreat, and I've got a week carved out. So I'm going to try and make some headway on a novel, which I'm not at leisure to disclose anything else about the novel other than it's a novel. But, you know, I'm not writing for a paycheck. I'm not writing for tenure. You know, I like to joke that it makes me like the most dangerous person to be writing anything, frankly, because
love it. I love it. I love that, because now you're not beholden to anybody, any corporation, any deadline.
Yeah. I'm just going to write what I write. Yeah. My agent hates it when I say that. She's just like, you're writing for me. Come on,
man. You know, I just discovered this writer. Have you heard of Joseph Wynn before?
No, I haven't.
Man, I just learned about this guy. He was on Rick Rubin. You know, Rick Rubin, the producer.
Yeah.
The music guy.
Yeah.
So for anybody who doesn't know who Rick Rubin is one of these guys who are super old school, you know, started out producing for the Beastie Boys and, you know, in recent years, you know, has worked with everybody in the music business. If you have an idea.
Book about creativity, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
He wrote this really cool book, and he has a podcast series now where, you know, he'll talk to Pharrell, he'll talk to all like the greats, you know, all the big people in the music business. He had Joseph Wynn on. I didn't even know who Joseph Wynn in until one of my friends go, dude, have you checked this guy? Have you had him on your podcast? And I was like, I've never even heard of him. Then I listened to the podcast, and then I realized like he was saying something. He goes, I did not have a book publishing deal from the get-go, so I self-published. And what I did was I read excerpts every day. I read like at least 3 to 5 times a day and put on my Instagram. And my Instagram grew. And pretty soon I was selling 20 to 30,000 copies a month.
Damn. Okay. Joseph Wynn. I'll check him out.
Joseph Wynn. Yeah. Huh. And he talks about, you know, stuff like, you know, it's very close to like Atomic Habits, and, you know, it's very mainstream in terms of like, you are not what you think you are. I forget the name of the book, but for everybody who's following Joseph Wynn these days, Joseph Wynn, what a gangster. He's written 4 books now, and now he's got this like super cool setup, which is he has a hybrid deal with the publishers. So the publishers want him so bad. They're like, no, what can we do to help? He's like, nothing really. Yeah. Can't do anything for me. But they're like, but dude, there's like bookstores and there's these things that you can't get to just simply because you know, and there's traditional people who buy from bookstores. And he's like, okay, let's do a hybrid. Whatever you put in these bookstores, we split the profits on the book. But whatever I'm making on my own, through my own channels, and people are ordering through me and my Instagram, I'm keeping that. What a genius. I mean, why are we all not doing that, right? Like,
Yeah, he like built his audience, right? It's like sort of what happened. Andy Weir, right? The author of The Martian, right? Like, he like wrote that and put it out in the internet, and then people lost their minds, and then he signed the book deals afterwards. Sometimes, right? It is a meritocracy, or it sure feels like it.
It really is.
Sometimes. Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you just gotta like study how it's being clocked by the algorithm, how it's done. Because I mean, you know, I think once you learn that and you grow, because I went from 16,000 followers at the beginning of this year. Now I'm at 24,000. So Whoa. After the first 5 years, I had people who I hired to come onto the team, and they figured it out. And now it's like, I get how this is done. You just have to understand the algorithm because the content hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. I've just figured out a new way to put the content into people's hands. And now, so I'm going to do exactly what Joseph Wynn does. You know, you just have to be very intentional about getting the word out there. And I think you can do it too. You know, you can read excerpts from your last book and just spend 3 to 5 minutes on, you know, so you read 90 seconds per clip, and you do that 3 or 5 times and just load it up from Saigon. You can do it from Saigon, right? From your last book, or any thoughts that you might have, you could just record 90 seconds and just do a lot of it and just keep uploading it, because the algorithm will start to work with you.
That's so interesting. Yeah. All right, I'm going to hire your team, I guess.
Yeah. Awesome. Fulk, thank you so much for coming on. Are there any other questions that I did not cover?
I don't think so. What would you, like, I guess, what would be your advice? Like, 3 things that you would tell somebody who was about to travel to Vietnam for the first time. I'm curious what you would say.
What a great question. I would, first off, this first answer is all encompassing. So I would write down all the things that I think Vietnam is, right? I'd write everything. I just spent weeks writing what I think it would be. And then when I get back, I would write down all the things that, the new thoughts that I had, because I think that side-by-side comparison and contrast is so fascinating to see how much we actually grow and extend our belief. Second thing I would probably do is have some goals that you want to do, some concrete intentions, you know, visit an orphanage, visit a place where blind people make crafts. And I would line up maybe a dozen of those, including, you know, food spots and stuff like that. I would definitely make a list of things so that when you get there, you can actually have very a heavy load of intention to look for the places that that you wrote down. And I think the third thing to do is to really experience cultural things, like going to a rap concert, like a 20,000-30,000 person rap concert in the city. Go see an opera in Vietnam. Go see real dancing, you know, like live dance performances in Vietnam. I would really, encourage these cultural things. Hanoi, I think, has a new opera house. There's so many things to do culturally in Vietnam, and I think making a list of those things are so important. Those are the 3 things I would, and then always write about it when you get home, so you don't forget what that first trip felt like. And
That's amazing. That's great. That's great advice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Great talking to you as always.
And I hope to see you soon. Talk about your book when you finish it.
Yeah. If I'm in Los Angeles, I'll drop you a line. Let's get together.
Please. We'd love that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Yeah, take care. Thanks.
Okay. All right, folks. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.